The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
I'm pretty sure it's the Philip K. Dick story or the other guy, but the idea is that basically... Welcome to Recotopia, a happy home for recommended movies, shows, and music from two people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson and Jeremy Scott.
You're rationalizing.
Well, that's what you do to go through with the shit you start. You rationalize. I can do it, Max. I know I can. I just can't do it without you.
This is Recotopia, and this is episode 5. I'm Chris Atkinson.
And I'm Jeremy Scott.
And today we'll be doing Jackie Brown as our big recommend. Man, that was fun watching again.
After a hiatus.
I used to watch it all the time.
We'll get into it when we talk about that movie.
Yeah. But first things first, I'm going to acknowledge the chat again. Hello, you wonderful people. I hope you guys are healthy and safe and happy in this moment. Hope you all are doing well. All right. So, let's get into our, small recommends that we have.
It's so small. It's so tiny.
It's no big deal.
It's so small and light.
It's small. It's tiny. It's petite. It's wee.
I do love the bumper, by the way, when we do these things, George thing. It's tiny. It's wee. I guess I'll go ahead. A movie from this past year, a documentary that is an animated documentary called Flea. I'm going to recommend here. This is an Afghan refugee who is talking to a filmmaker throughout this movie, and he tells us exactly what's going on that leads him to have to escape his country and all of the bullshit that you have to go through in order to move from one country to another or to find loved ones and his story. I don't know how typical it is. I don't know where you would put it on the, like, oh my God, that was harrowing scale. Like, his is pretty harrowing. Like, I would say I would never want to have to go through this in my lifetime. But he and his family had to go through a lot of stuff to get out of Afghanistan. And then they found themselves in Russia and they had to find a way to get out of Russia and pay. They had to pay traffickers. They had to pay traffickers to get them out. And you can go with cheap traffickers and hope that you get to a certain point, or you can go with really expensive traffickers, which, you know, you're not going to have very much money. Done in such a remarkable way. Like, it's animated. Once you watch this, you're like, I don't know how you would do this documentary any other way, because it's a guy talking about his experiences. You don't actually have footage of what's going on here, so you have to dramatize it in some way. And I think that if they had tried to get an actor or, you know, somebody like that to reenact it or whatever, it would have come off cheap. So the animation of it and everything, I think that's really, I've never seen anything like, I haven't seen a documentary like this in a while. I guess God, what is that one movie, that Iranian film that came out many years ago, and I can't remember the name of it right now, had something similar to that. It was more of a sort of a biography. I'll have to look that up at some point. But anyway, yeah, Flea is really good. I highly recommend it.
Excellent.
It is. I can't remember which streaming service it is, but find an app, find your Real Good app, and put it on. And I think it's like Amazon. I think Amazon has it.
Amazon. All right. Well, on my first small recommend, and it truly is small, is the new Aziz Ansari stand-up special.
I've
Netflix.
Seen this.
It's only 30 minutes, mm-hmm. which is maybe the worst thing about it. I really like Aziz. Chris, you and I went and saw him in Nashville live. And you said you've seen this, right?
Yeah, I've seen it.
It's very topical. It's almost all pandemic, current event related stuff. It was recorded in December, I believe. And he just walked into the Comedy Store, and everybody who was there did not know he was coming. Their evening was done. They'd seen a bunch of great comics. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly, here's Aziz Ansari. He's going to do a sudden stand-up set. Mm-hmm. My favorite bit is when he does this thing with Ice Cube, not wanting the vaccine.
Yeah.
And he says, you know, 2 months before the pandemic, Ice Cube had a colonoscopy. Mm-hmm. So this guy, he does like 3 minutes of, he's like, I'm going to drink a bunch of shit, clean my system out. I'm going to lay face down on a table while I'm passed out and let you shove a rubber tube up my ass, but I'm not going to take the vaccine. He goes on and on and on. And then he's just suddenly says, I don't know if Ice Cube actually had COVID.
Yeah. What's funny is that story is relatable, because we have heard so many of these things where people will do one thing, but they won't do this. So it comes off very true and believable, even if it's not, you know, it is great that he sort of, totally blindsides you with that. I don't know if that happened or not.
Yeah. I thought it was a great rug pull there. But if you like Aziz, it's 30 minutes, very timely, topical, classic Aziz. I thought it was very funny. I just wanted more. So that's my first, that's on Netflix. If I didn't say that already, that's my first small recommend.
My next recommend is, Asghar Farhadi's a Hero, which is, this guy has made the one that I think is most popular here is A Separation, is the one movie that a lot of people have heard of that he's done. He also did a movie that I saw on Mubi called Fireworks Wednesday, which is really good. And it is about a guy who is in a debtor's prison, and he's on leave, and he feels like he's got a plan that he can pay off the guy he's indebted to, which is like a brother-in-law. He can pay him off, or at least pay half of it off, and get out of the debtor's prison and work off the rest. And so his plan is basically his future wife has either found or stolen, stolen or found, I don't remember if they actually say, a purse full of coins that are worth nearly what half of what he owes back to this guy. And meanwhile, in this 2-day leave, this guy is making the rounds. He comes back to see his sister, and his sister finds the bag and says, look, you know, I don't know what you're up to, but you know, you don't do anything that is going to ruin the family name, which and when you watch this movie becomes a very ironic statement. So he gets a conscience, and when he goes to evaluate the coins, they find out that the money is not exactly what he was hoping it would be. So he's like, oh, maybe we can just wait a little bit and maybe the price will go up. And in the meantime, he's like, you know what? This is wrong. We should actually put posters around the town and advertise that we found this purse, call this number, and give it back. So he thinks that what's probably going to happen is no one's going to claim it, and then And then he'll have his future wife call and say that she was the one who lost the bag, and that they'll just get it back that way. But it's only a day. A day come goes by, and the person who lost the bag calls in. And just through a variety of you know, plot steps here, the good deed becomes a whole key into him getting a job, paying off that debt for real. He's going to have a news report on him where they're going to talk about how what a great thing he's done is. All this is going to get him back into the proper life. But there are people who start doubting the story. And because of the doubts of that story, and because there's not any good, solid detail on what's what actually happened, that doubt starts to turn against him seriously after a while. I love the characters in this because it's one of these where the guy obviously wasn't going to do the right thing. Then he decides to do the right thing, and it sort of asked the question, how far can you go to not do the right thing before and then turn around to do the right thing? Does it become a problem? And the guy he owes money to is one of these people in movies where you're like, oh, what a dick this guy is. He wants his money back. What a fucker, you know, that because, he's sitting there going like, he's like, why is this guy being praised for suddenly doing the right thing or whatever? I don't find purses out in the, you know, I haven't been able to find a purse out there and do that and get on the news and like get money and all this other stuff. And he's absolutely right. Like he's it's one of those villains, quote unquote, in movies who are completely right about what he's saying. I love all the moral quandaries that this movie offers, and it is a resounding recommend here.
Awesome.
For a hero.
Resounding.
Yes. I know we're in our small recommends, and we're only small right now. No, we've always said that the small recommends are not small in stature. They are
big things come in small recommend packages.
Yes,
packages.
Absolutely.
Our beloved producer probably has an image fired up for my second small recommend, but I'm going off book as I am wont to do, because I saw a movie last night after I sent my notes, and it's called Good Time, and it stars Robert Pattinson.
Oh, I've seen this.
And this is a Safdie.
I think it's Safdie.
This is a Safdie Brothers film. I have still not seen Uncut Gems because everybody said it would make me anxious.
Yeah, but Good Time is that same kind of deal.
Made me anxious. The way it's shot, this film is fucking bonkers in terms of, if I were to describe the plot to you, you would say, there's no way I'm watching that. Because it's freaking bonkers. I don't want to spoil too much of it, but basically Pattinson and one of the Safdie brothers are playing brothers in the film. I think it's, I don't know his first name,
is it
the
Benny?
Safdie brother. I think it's Benny. He's playing a mentally ill character. And so Pattinson breaks him out of therapy, takes him with him to rob a freaking bank. They get blasted in the face with a dye pack, and basically, his brother ends up getting caught and getting arrested, but he's hurt, so he goes to the hospital, and Pattinson breaks him out, and like 35 minutes later, you find out, nope, broke out the wrong guy, just a guy that had head bandages on that wasn't his brother at all, and they become like, for like brothers in crime for a while, and break into a amusement park, and there's a uncomfortable kiss with a 16-year-old girl.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It's just, the movie is fucking bonkers, but I thought it was really great. I don't know how to really justify that. I guess by the end, you know, he makes the right decisions, and you can see an arc there. I haven't seen anything like it, and I guess this is what the Safdie brothers are known for, is this style of filmmaking that just takes you on a ride. And it's wild and fast-paced and anxiety-inducing. And
I will say, if you can take good time, I would watch Uncut Gems, although I think Uncut Gems is possibly more anxiety-driven than that movie is, just because of how much is at stake during the final 20 minutes of the movie. But I mean, it's got anxiety all the way through it. I mean, it's just the way the characters are written and how they're presented throughout. But I would highly recommend Uncut Gems to you if you liked. Some people may argue Good Time is a better movie than Uncut Gems. Hmm. I don't know if that's the case or not. I haven't read a whole bunch about one or the other, but as far as comparing the two. I really enjoyed it. I don't know how most people feel about that movie, but I think you might like it. And especially considering it's a different kind of Adam Sandler movie.
Yeah, I'm definitely more inclined to watch it now, having seen, I was halfway into Good Time before I Googled it to see who had made it. But there's my small recommend number two. And now it's time for the main event.
It's time for the big recommend. All right, it's time to talk about HelloFresh.
HelloFresh. You know, you can cook meals at home in a relatively short amount of time that are restaurant quality and healthy for you. And all you have to do is check out HelloFresh. You don't have to eat the same fast food over and over and over again. HelloFresh, I've mentioned this before, has made me a better cook. It has taught me about certain ingredients, techniques, flavor combinations that were brand new to me that I now recreate regularly in my own cooking. Just glancing at the menu for this upcoming week, meatballs with bulgogi sauce, silky Sicilian penne and chicken, one pan pork carnitas tacos.
Oh my.
Oh my gosh. I'm telling you, this stuff is full of variety. HelloFresh actually offers 50 menu and market items to choose from every single week. And the options include veggie, calorie smart, family friendly, and gourmet. Mm-hmm. So there's tons of variety. You don't just have to get those handful of delicious sounding recipes that I just threw out there that they're going to have coming up this week. You can choose different plans, whether you're a single person or family, whether you have dietary needs, they've got options for you. And right now, if you go to HelloFresh.com/Recotopia16, that's 1-6. You can get up to 16 free meals.
Yes.
If you use the code RECOTOPIA16. That is significant. 16 meals. You know, obviously it depends on the plan you choose, but man, take advantage of that, guys. That's a lot of free food. And we have firsthand experience making this stuff. They send you the portions you need. They send you all the ingredients. And they walk you through it step by step. You'll end up keeping these recipe cards like my wife and I do and making these recipes again down the road when you find your favorites. So go to HelloFresh.com/Recotopia16. Enter the code Recotopia16 and get up to 16 meals free. Do it today.
All right, everybody. It's time to talk about BetterHelp.
BetterHelp, man. You know, just when you think things can't get much worse than a pandemic, a war breaks out. And it's no hyperbole to say that times have been stressful for almost darn near everyone. And it just keeps piling on. And even if you don't have a diagnosis of anxiety like I do, you probably could use somebody to talk to. Somebody who is a trained, licensed therapist who knows how to talk you through what you're going through and help you come up with tools to react to stressing situations so that you can keep your anxiety, your stress down, at least as much as humanly possible. I have been doing therapy for a long time. BetterHelp brings that kind of healing without you having to leave your own home. Just going to somebody's office and sitting in a strange room can be stressful for a lot of people. Therapy really works best when you can be open and comfortable and relaxed. And so one of the reasons I love BetterHelp is the options. If I want to do a session via email, I can. If I want to do a video call, I can. If I want to do a phone call, I can. I can even do text messages. I have my own little dashboard. I can message my therapist. Almost always get matched with the therapist near you, but they make it super easy to switch if you're not clicking because they know the therapist-patient relationship needs to click. If you go to BetterHelp.com/Recotopia and use the code Recotopia, you can get up to 10% off your first month. And that's not nothing. I am telling you that there have been times that therapy has saved my life. And whether you have serious debilitating depression or anxiety, or you just feel like the world is kind of scary right now and you want to talk through some stuff, I really recommend BetterHelp. Go to betterhelp.com/recotopia. Use the code recotopia. You get up to 10% off your first month, and I believe it can help you.
I'm fine. I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
1997's Jackie Brown, Quentin Tarantino follow-up to Pulp Fiction. This is his third movie at this point, but it feels kind of like what a sophomore movie would be like, because Pulp Fiction was the movie that really, really put Tarantino on the map. So yep. His follow-up was always going to be a letdown for some people when it wasn't Pulp Fiction again. Yeah. I don't remember how I felt when I first watched this movie. I don't remember that. But I do remember about, I don't know, a year or so afterwards thinking, this is better than Pulp Fiction. I like this better than Pulp Fiction.
Mm-hmm.
I think it holds up a little bit better. I think also, I'm trying to think if this might be my favorite Tarantino movies ever, because since then he's made a lot of like really like over the top kind of movies. I think Inglourious Basterds might be in the conversation, but all even though it goes like super crazy at one point, but I don't know. This one has always had the magic for me. This one is just fantastic. It's based on an Elmore Leonard novel called Rum Punch, which I read after the fact, and I liked Rum Punch. You know, I'm partial to the movie probably because I saw it first, but Tarantino changed a couple of things. First off, you know, it's not a white woman at the forefront; it's a black woman, and her name's not Jackie Burke anymore. It's Jackie Brown, which is a play on Foxy Brown. Even the way they do the title is just like how they did Foxy Brown back in the day. And Pam Grier, I think Tarantino had always wanted to work with Pam Grier. There's talk on the Jackie Brown DVD about how he wanted her in Pulp Fiction. He wanted her to play Rosanna Arquette's character. I think they'd already hired Rosanna Arquette, but he wanted to put her through the audition anyway. And basically said, we'll definitely work together someday at some point. And she was like, yeah, right, and whatever. But apparently she went into his office and saw, like, all these posters, like Coffee and Foxy Brown and all this other stuff was up there. And she's like, oh, you really do like me. Jackie Brown I don't know. Would you say it's not a complex? I guess it's complex in the fact that there's a lot of moving parts to the what Jackie Brown wants to do in this movie. It's a slow burn for about an hour and 20 minutes or so, and then once it gets to the trial run of the money exchange at the mall, it blows by like just incredibly fast. And even though it's 2 hours and 40 minutes, it goes by like that.
It really does. I agree with you. This is my favorite Tarantino film. And I think this is just my feeling, and maybe somebody else feels like this, but this is his most grounded movie.
Mm-hmm.
This is the least amount of excess, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like you talked about how Inglourious Basterds near the finale just goes off the rails in ways that many people love.
Mm-hmm.
Even Pulp Fiction. The reason Jackie Brown was a letdown for so many people was that Pulp Fiction was so full of excess, mm-hmm. excessive violence, excessive swearing, excessive N-word. It's over the top. Mm-hmm. And Jackie Brown feels like real people that were not in the same, even though I know he peppers all of his movies with Red Apple cigarettes or whatever.
Right.
It doesn't feel like I'm in the same universe as his other films. And that's why I appreciate this movie more than the rest of his. When he goes to excessive places, I don't always enjoy it. And this, like you said, it's a slow burn for about an hour and 20 minutes. But I think the reason it doesn't feel complicated is the way he shoots it.
Mm-hmm.
The way he lets us understand things without necessarily spoon feeding everything. And then when we get to the actual exchange and he does his Rashomon thing, where we get to see basically the same period of time from multiple different perspectives, different characters and what they saw.
Mm-hmm.
It's masterful. And I wouldn't have blamed him if he dropped the mic and walked off and never made another movie. Mm-hmm. It's just riveting.
Yeah. The thing about this movie that I think elevates it over so many others is how smart everybody is.
Hmm.
There's not anybody in this that just does something stupid, or if they do something stupid, it's because of something else, there's some other reason behind it. Even like De Niro, who's playing Louis Guerra in this, and Bridget Fonda, who's playing Melanie, have their smarts in this. They have their own smarts. Now, they do underestimate, especially Melanie's character, and underestimates everybody that she's encounters. And yep. I wouldn't consider her dumb or anything. Like, that's I think she's just, she smokes a lot of weed and she underestimates people. It's funny the way they set up, not funny, but it's great the way they set up Jackie Brown's character, because she is a flight attendant on some shitty airline, and it basically, I think it takes one trip, LA to Cabo and then Cabo back. It's basically what it does. And she gets in and when she is accosted by Michael Keaton, by the way, plays Ray Nicolette and later plays him in Out of Sight after this. Mm. When she gets accosted by Michael Keaton and Michael Bowen in this, she's like, oh, okay, we know what this is all about. And she knows not to say anything. That's the big thing.
Yeah.
She knows not to say anything. Don't mention anybody's name, nothing, because that's going to kill her if she does. It's going to make time for her worse. And she finds out very quickly that Beaumont, played by Chris Tucker, was about to give them everything before he was killed. And this is another great thing about Samuel Jackson's character, Ordell Roby, because he realizes that he knows that Beaumont can't do that time immediately, realizes that he needs, I'm not an advocate of murder, but I'm saying, I'm saying that if I'm in that business and I know what Ordell Roby knows, then his actions are extremely justified here. When he takes Beaumont out in this movie. She realizes, look, I'm not going to say a fucking word, and that's perfect. And she realizes, look, I'm in my mid 40s. I don't really like this job. I don't want to go to jail. Now I have an opportunity in front of me. And she starts thinking about a huge plan that is awesome, like it's a ridiculously awesome plan, where she's going to take money in and she's going to tell the feds one thing and tell Ordell Roby another thing, and meanwhile get to keep what is $500,000 by the end of it. Now I think there are probably some plot holes in some of this stuff, but it doesn't matter. It's just the way it comes off is fantastic, because she thinks about it. She thinks about all the angles. That's what I love about this movie, is like every decision seems justified in it.
I noticed this time through how little regard for human life Ordell has.
Mm-hmm.
Like, everyone is a tool to him, and when that tool becomes dangerous or no longer useful, he doesn't hesitate for a minute to kill them. He shoots De Niro, his lifelong buddy who just got out of prison because De Niro was dumb and shot Melanie in the parking lot.
Yeah.
And became a liability. Jackie Brown, he obviously had at some point some general affection for her, maybe not romantic, but you know, he'll kill her the first chance he gets, because he himself is all that matters. Everyone else is disposable to him. And I know we talked about this on previous podcasts, but I love that bit in the minivan, in the Libyan's van or whatever it is. That was the Back to the Future. Where he tells Ordell that he shot Melanie. And he's like, is she dead?
Yeah.
He's like, pretty much.
Yeah, pretty much.
Like, got an answer? Is she dead? And he says, I think so.
This is... This is some of my this is dialogue that runs through my head on a daily basis. This stuff in Jackie Brown, just the way Samuel Jackson delivers it and everything. He's like, "Oh, you asking me to reason? You lost every goddamn cent I have in the world," and he's like this, and he's like, "The truth is, your ass ain't worth a shit no more." And then like Lewis is like, "Hey, you better back off." And then there's that look that Samuel Jackson puts on his face, like, "Motherfucker." You know, and just, and then shoots him. But that this is, to me, this is one that should have been nominated. Samuel Jackson should have been nominated for this. I looked at the 1997 acting categories, both. Now, sometimes you're like, oh, kind of hard to fit in. This would not have been hard to fit in. You could have easily lost three in each category. For 1997, this was the year that Jack Nicholson won for As Good As It Gets, and the supporting actor was Robin Williams. Now the winners, you can say, may have gotten that right, but then like the nominees, I'm sitting there going, do we even remember Greg Kinnear in As Good As It Gets? I don't think I remembered he was in that movie, and he got nominated for it.
I didn't know he got nominated.
Yeah. So yeah, Jackie Brown on the whole just got completely ignored because it wasn't Pulp Fiction. I always will come back to that. It wasn't Pulp Fiction Part 2, so they just didn't look at it. And they gave Robert Forster a well-deserved Oscar nomination for this. He is so good in this movie. And man, we're going to be all over the place on this movie. Remember when we talked about, I don't remember if we talked about it in previous podcasts or talked about it on this one, but we were like, the fuck does he not go with Jackie at the end of this movie?
Oh yeah.
Why does he not do it? And I came to the conclusion, and I've got even more after this explanation I've come up. The explanation I came up with is he's always done the right thing. He's always been a do-gooder. He's always like, you know, he doesn't want to change his life in that meaningful of a way. He's always been that way. So, like, he turns it down. Now, what happens is he gets that phone call, and I think halfway through it, he's like, man, this is dumb. What am I doing? And halfway through that phone call, he tells the person that, you know, he's trying to get the bail bond for, can I call you back in 30 minutes? Thinking that he's going to be able to get back to her before he gets off the phone. But before he's even off the phone, she drives off. And it's I'd never really thought about this scene before. He walks off and Tarantino puts him completely in a blurry frame.
Mm.
And it's so sad to watch that scene because he realizes he done fucked up. And it added even more to this movie that I already love, that Tarantino shot Forster that way. After that scene where he realizes I just gave up a great, like, rest of my life right there.
I mean, I don't want to cause too many ripples, but I feel like I could make the argument that he's the main character.
Yeah.
That, well, especially with the way you've just framed that ending, like the movie doesn't end with her with the wind in her hair, she's driving down the highway laughing. It ends with him in a blurry frame.
Well, it ends. it is on her at the end.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I
just got those out of.
No, yeah. Right after that, it shows her singing across 110th Street. Okay.
Well, I still think I could argue that he's the main character, but my case is weaker now.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think I'd normally be with you on some of these. It's clearly her movie. This is about a person who had come to that crossroads and has decided, you know, I'm gonna take a huge gamble here, and either I'm gonna go to prison for a really long time, or I'm gonna do this, not go to prison, and just have my same old life, or I'm gonna walk off with $500,000.
I wonder what an odds maker would say her odds were to pull that off.
Yeah.
Because I would think that was a pretty big swing. Like that was a Hail Mary at that point, right? She was either facing prison or death. And so she had to give it one last try. And how often does a Hail Mary work out in football?
Right. And you know, in this movie, like I said, there are some plot holes to the whole. I mean, this is why you have the scene with Ray Nicolette after the money exchange has gone down, and he's basically trying to get her to say something stupid so that he can, because he knows she did something. He knows she pulled something off, but he can't prove it. But you know, like I do find it weird that they didn't surveil her from the moment that she is going into the store. I also find it weird that her story, where she's running out of the dressing room frantic and that she had to pay the sales girl and all this, they didn't ask the sales girl what she remembers about all of that. She doesn't remember. Like, you would think also that they would have brought up, did she have another package with her, or did she have anything with, you know, it seems like those questions would be asked. Does not detract from my enjoyment of the movie, but in any way, by the way. But
right.
On this new viewing of it, I was sitting there going, "Man, these guys would have been all over that sales girl and would have been asking her questions left and right about this, because she would have remembered this." It's weird that they don't ask her all that, but I just, everything about this, I just, even stuff like, think about how innocent this meetup is when Forster comes out of the movie and he's at the mall and he's going to look for something to eat, and Ordell just happens to be there at the same time, like walking away, sees him, and then sees him go down to talk to Jackie in the food court. At first, that's just an innocent run-in, but he knows, he's like, what the fuck is this shit? And he's right to think there's something going on there, even though at the time there isn't anything going on there. I love those scenes like that. I love the whole interaction too, when they're just now getting into the flirty phase and he's like, "Oh, I didn't even see you there." And he goes, "Yeah, you were there ignoring me as always," or something like that. And then they come down and start talking, and it's just, we could go on and on, I'm sure.
Yeah. It's a good one. What little thoughts do we have about this film that are not, that Robert Forster was the main character? I was going to say, how about the soundtrack? Tarantino's, I think, always good with the soundtrack.
Mm-hmm.
But the music becomes part of story almost. It certainly does, in that Forster buys the cassette that he heard her
the
playing.
The Delphonics, yeah.
But just all the songs that he chooses are basically perfect. When she's walking with that Across 110th Street song playing, it's not the title of the song.
I think it is, actually.
Oh, is it?
I think it is.
I think even in the movies that I don't love that he's made, Tarantino has always been one of the masters at choosing soundtracks and employing that music in the best way possible. And so that's one of the things that I always notice when I watch this movie, is how awesome the music, how perfect the music choices are.
Yeah. That Delphonics thing is great in so many ways. The she plays it on a record at the beginning, and here, and you know, you start talking about some dated type stuff that's in this movie. She's like, she's like, she puts it on a record and goes, "What? You not go to the? You never get into CDs?" And he's like, "Nah, I don't really like the new stuff, and I still have my albums." And goes, "Well, you can't get new stuff on records anymore." And like, you know, of course, we've gone full circle with the vinyl at this point, but. She plays that song at the beginning, and then because he's got this, you know, he's starting to fall in love with her and everything, he's like, "I'm going to buy this Delphonics," and it sort of remind me of her. But like, I love how he's playing that song going to the mall, and he cuts it off, and there's this long period of time, and then he turns it back on, and it's right there at that spot again. Because it's on a cassette. And then later on, it's still on when he gets Ordell Roby in the car, and Ordell turns to him and goes, "I didn't know you liked the Delphonics." And he's like, "They're pretty good."
He has so many good dry deliveries in this movie.
Yeah. I love, too, Ordell's when he gives the address to Forster at the beginning. And, you know, he says, "This is a... you know, blah, 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 Compton, California." And he goes, "Is that a house or an apartment?" And he goes, "That's a house." You know, like, this is the last great year of Robert De Niro. This is one of his last great performances. 1997, he was in this, he was in Wag the Dog. He was in Copland. This was a good year for De Niro. One of the things that's interesting about his performance, and I was watching some of the extras on the Blu-ray, was you know, he is playing this character like a guy who has not been in the world for 4 years. He is interacting with things that he hasn't ever interacted with, like the, you know, the boop 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 alarm on the car, and the and which another Ordell great, "Don't touch my levels though." I like him more. But De Niro is not only out of prison for 4 years, he starts smoking all that weed with Melanie, and there's a point where he's on the phone and he has no affect to his face whatsoever, and Ordell's like, Lewis, he's like, is he there, and then he spends like another 30 seconds turning that phone around and around and around, trying to hang it up on the receiver. This is one of my favorite De Niro performances, and it comes after what you would consider peak De Niro. Because it's just so, I don't know, it's a real, it feels real. He played a lot of psychos before this, and this feels like a real person. So, yeah.
And he's usually he's the head gangster or the, you know, head psycho, but here he's just kind of a doofus at times, but he's just kind of a guy.
Yeah.
You haven't seen that a lot in his career before or after this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess I wanted to talk a little bit briefly about the years people were having here. So De Niro was having a great 1997. I think Samuel Jackson was in Eve's Bayou in this year. He was also in 187, which is, you know, it's okay movie. Michael Keaton had that 2 or 3 year hiatus there for a while where he wasn't in anything. And then he started showing up and stuff like this, and then Out of Sight and stuff like that. But then he had another sort of, I don't know, hiatus or something afterwards after that, because he did that Jack Frost movie. But Robert Forster, this was a resurrection in his career, much like Travolta before him. He was a guy that, you know, I think that Tarantino said something to the effect that nobody knew he was still around. He was doing these really low budget movies that nobody really, he was not A-list, B-list, or even C-list at the time. And then he comes in, he gets nominated for an Oscar here, and then he's suddenly in everything that you watched after this. So, it was great for the cast. Although, I don't know, Pam Grier, I think, did okay after this, but, you know, it may have been her last big.
She did not get the Travolta type bump after this.
Yeah. And Forster did. Probably says more about who's writing and directing movies than it has sure. anything about to do about her. So,
I agree.
Anyway, yeah. Let's see. Let's
double feature.
Yeah, let's do the double feature.
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
It's double feature time, everybody. Super secret double feature. This was tough, but fun.
Okay.
Because my very first thought I have already done as a super secret double feature, and that was the movie Fresh.
Okay.
A 1994 movie about chess.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, Out of Sight would be the easy one. Mm-hmm. If I wanted to make money with this double feature, I would program Jackie Brown and Out of Sight. Not just because Michael Keaton's playing the same character in both, but they're both based on Elmore Leonard novels. They do feel like they're in the same universe. That would be too easy. Of course, I'm not going to choose that.
Mm-hmm.
What I see in Jackie Brown is somebody who is caught with danger on more than one side, like in a pincer move in battle,
mm-hmm.
who then outwits, outsmarts, and outlasts, like Survivor,
mm-hmm.
All the dangers that there are. She's got Ordell to worry about. She's got the cops to worry about. And she pulls it off. So that was my thinking when I was looking for a double feature, is what movie gives me that same vibe? And you accidentally stole my thunder because I'm choosing Copland.
Oh, okay.
which does have De Niro in it. Mm-hmm. So there's a De Niro connection.
Yep.
Another connection is this is a unusual role for Stallone, a much more subdued. He's the guy that's downtrodden and everybody, you know, makes fun of him, basically. Mm-hmm. So the premise here is he's the sheriff of a small town in Jersey right across the water from New York, and it's populated by New York cops who are corrupt as hell.
Mm-hmm.
They don't respect his authority. They do whatever they want, and for various reasons, including a previous injury to his ear, he's just very meek and gets walked all over by these corrupt New York cops. And then you've got De Niro, who's basically investigating corrupt cops in New York. And this all comes to a boil in this small New Jersey town. And without spoiling it, similar to Jackie Brown, Stallone's character evades all the dangers around him to end up escaping and, quote unquote, saving the day, mm-hmm. if you will. I think the tone is a little less bright.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's not as much humor in Copland as there is in Jackie Brown, but thematically, I think they're a pretty good match. So there you go. My double feature is Copland.
I could see Copland being a big recommend in a later episode, too. James Mangold, I think he said something to the effect that one part of that movie that didn't become a big part, but it was something that he wanted to explore with Copland, is just that the fact that the cops don't live in the areas that they police very right. often, and it leads to a lot of misunderstandings. And so instead of living in the place that they're and you know, that gives you an incentive to make it as nice as possible when you live in that neighborhood and you know the people and everything. But instead, a lot of these cops live in other neighborhoods and they don't get don't have that same sense of pride. They come into a neighborhood thinking everybody's the other at that point. And that, I'm sure that's been explored in some other movies, but I'd love to see a big movie make a big splash talking about that very topic and everything. And this is, it's funny. James Mangold has definitely gotten this huge boost from his recent movies and everything, but he came out with a lot of good stuff in the 90s. It's hard to believe that he's been around this long. So,
yeah, he's ultimately going to have a career that's just fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Heavy was the first movie I saw of his, may have been his first film. That was great.
Mm-hmm.
He's one of the directors I'm always interested in seeing what they're doing. Let me go ahead and give you guys homework for next week's episode.
Mm-hmm.
The big recommend, because I can't stop talking about it, is going to be Fresh, a 1994 movie about chess that also stars Samuel L. Jackson, who is already leading the actors we've talked about most on Wreckatopia. Fresh can be found, for those of you who are looking for it, on Sling. It can be found on Showtime. It can be found on Amazon Prime. It can be found on the Roku channel. And it's available for rent for as little as $2 or $3.99 at YouTube, Apple, Vudu, so on and so forth. So if you are able, seek out Fresh. And next week, we will dive into yet another character who is surrounded by danger on all sides and somehow comes up with a plan to get themselves out of it.
So this episode, you know, this episode right now that we're doing, the Jackie Brown one, for most people will be the one that comes out on the 7th. Then we'll do... We'll do a live one on the 8th for our Patreon members for Fresh on the 8th, and that will be the one that comes out on the 14th. And then we will do the Batman. The Batman will be March 15th. And that will be an interesting one, because if we don't like it, we will totally be opposite of recommending things. So it'll be interesting to do a movie that we don't know. Although, to be fair, it has been getting great reviews just before its release. So I'm looking forward to it, even though it's going to be a long one. It's going
to
be a long one.
It is. I'm going to have to go to the bathroom. Probably somewhere in the middle of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't need to tell people about my bladder habits.
You
what am
know,
I doing?
You know.
Let's get into some questions.
Let's
we
do
have
it.
A little bit of time.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I am listening.
Whose original accent surprised you the most? Meaning you heard someone doing an American or British accent or other accent and it was perfect, but then you later found out they were of another ethnicity or nationality and had just done a great fake voice.
Well, I'll tell you... not that she did a great accent or anything, but I just had this, even though I had seen Shannon Elizabeth before, I did not remember who she was. She showed up in some movies just before American Pie, but okay. But American Pie was the first time I had ever seen her, and not that she's doing a great Russian accent or anything in that. I just thought she was not American in that. And so then to find out later after that movie came out that she's like from Texas and everything, I was like, what? I thought she really was like, I don't know. I thought she was, I think at 22, I think she, when that movie came out, I really thought she was Russian. the one that really, surprised me was Amelia Jones, because, that was, I didn't think she was British. She's like, I mean, every, did I say that wrong? Yeah. Amelia Jones in Coda, because I thought that she was American, and, you know, like we said before, you Brits, can get that American accent down so well. Like, I don't even hear a trace of British at all in that whole thing. It was just weird to see interviews when we did Coda as our big recommend. I was watching interviews and she's sitting there talking in a British accent. And I was like, "What? This is not right. This is not right.
Yeah.
That's not you, yeah. Amelia." So that really shocked me. So
I mean the all-time classic. I think at some point in their life, everybody has had this with Christian Bale. When you first realize Christian Bale is British, I mean, one of the reasons that it took so long. Of course, I think you and I learned this ages ago, but one of the reasons it took so long for people to learn that is that he would continue doing the American accent all throughout the press tour
yeah,
for the movie
yeah.
where his characters were American, which is just a choice, and I respect it. But my answers are twofold, both, I believe, from Great Britain. I don't want to say the wrong thing. Andrew Garfield in Social Network.
Yeah.
No idea that dude was not American.
Yeah.
And Damian Lewis in Band of Brothers first, but in everything Damian Lewis has done. Mm-hmm. But I watched Band of Brothers, I watched the whole thing probably two or three times through before I learned that Damian Lewis was British
mm-hmm.
and or Irish. I don't want to offend. Not American. and from one of those little islands up there. Mm-hmm. But those were two more recent ones for me that I was blown away.
Christian Bale for sure, and Damian Lewis. I had not seen him. I still haven't seen all of Band of Brothers. I am shame. I have the Blu-ray set, by the way, if I ever do want to watch it. So I have that, and I have the other one that came out afterwards. The other World War II HBO.
Yeah, the Pacific.
I was like, help me out here.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I was reading this comment that says, I was surprised to find out Tommy Wiseau is a human.
Yep. Very true. Very true. But Damian Lewis, I first saw on the show Life, which only had one season, and I really enjoyed it. But I didn't have any idea. And yeah, Metz cast also says House MD Hugh Laurie, which is, it's funny. This is how dumb we Americans are. We didn't realize he had, Fry and Laurie and all this other stuff in the UK before all this. I was like, I didn't know that he was a big deal before he was House and everything. He's like, now I know.
There's a big episode of Friends where they go to London for a wedding, and it's littered with famous British funny people.
Mm-hmm.
But when I'm watching it as it airs in the fifth season, I don't know any of those people. I don't know who any of them are, but the show was like, hey, here's Hugh Laurie. He's famous for doing this thing over in London town or whatever, but I didn't know.
Yeah.
I was ignorant.
Yeah. And I'd even seen Hugh Laurie before, too. I just didn't remember him. He was in Sense and Sensibility, and he plays the husband of somebody.
Oh, that's right.
And there's a point where his wife, he's obviously in a marriage that he doesn't care for. He just kind of, like, tolerates it or whatever. And his wife is like, maybe we should do this and that. And he goes, we'll do nothing of the sort. You know? So.
All right. Here's a fun one. What movie from before you were born would you most like to go back and experience with an audience seeing it for the first time?
We both mentioned, by the way, 2001. That would have been my first choice. 2001 would have been great. I want to see movies that have a modicum of audience participation, even if people were quiet during it or whatever. So stuff like West Side Story and The Sound of Music would be interesting to watch with huge crowds back in the day, just to see if people are like kind of like getting into this, you know, to the music and maybe even singing along. Who knows?
Hmm.
And then I was thinking also a comedy like It's a Mad, 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 Mad World would have been fun to watch, even though it's 3 hours long, 3 hour long comedy. But with all these different huge comedy stars that are in that movie, at the time, I think there would have been going into an audience for a movie like that would have been fun. And I still have that projectionist mentality or that movie theater worker mentality about walking in on auditoriums where people are laughing and having a great time. Those were always the best, experiences when you worked at movie theaters. So.
Yeah, yeah. I went Arsenic and Old Lace, which is in my opinion, a riotous comedy that I laugh all the way through. And for the same reasons you were just saying, I want to be in an audience of that era in a packed house hearing. Now, I don't currently want to be in a packed house for any reason, but in the spirit of the question, to hear, you know, a sold out audience just dying laughing all throughout this thing, because what's great about Arsenic and Old Lace is the comedy is not specific to the era. What's funny about that is funny today, even as it was funny back when it was released. So
yeah, it's funny.
That would be my answer.
I'm looking at the comments, and I'll tell you why some of these don't show up in our own answers, because we're old as fuck. Lollipop Shoes says Empire Strikes Back. Sorry, we were born before that movie came out. The Godfather. Now that was definitely out before we were born. That would have been a great one. Josh says Caligula. That would be a fucking awful experience in a theater. Reefer Madness is thrown out there. That'd be funny.
I see Alien.
We were born before Alien came out. Although, to be fair, We weren't old enough to watch that movie, so
no.
it could still still, you know, same I thing for four. Empire. Yes.
Yeah, if anybody had shown me Alien when it came out, that they should be put in jail.
Mm-hmm.
When I was 4 years old.
Correct. Correct. But Back to the Future is thrown up there, and of course I was 8 when that came out. But yeah. Anyway.
All right. pardon me. Moving on. What are some terrible movies that you can see a good movie in?
Okay. Transformers, for me. Because every time a new Transformer, now the first Transformers is the best Transformers, out of the Michael Bay group. All the rest of them are just hot garbage. And the reason why they're hot garbage is because there's just too many, there's just too many things in it. There's too many artifacts, ancient artifacts. They got to go on quests to find. There's too many of that. There's too much just in your face dumb humor. And I don't mind dumb humor at all. It's just after 2.5 hours, it just starts to grate on my soul. And all these movies are 2.5 hours. And every time I would say something about this, a defender would be like, all it is robots fighting, and that's all you have to worry about. And I was like, no, if it was just robots fighting, I would be all over these movies. Make it an hour and 40 minutes and make it just robots fighting. And because they just want Earth, that's all that can't, you don't need to have an artifact. Just make it where they need Earth for some reason and then have a bunch of robots fight over and over again. I'm totally cool with that. Instead, they had to make some big, huge mythology like it was fucking Lord of the Rings or some shit. And I'm like, no.
Yeah.
This is not how you do this.
No. They did put Kevin Dunn in it. That's always a good move.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was a great answer. I'm ashamed of my answers. That was a good one. I'm going to go with In Time, the Justin Timberlake 2010 movie, I think. There are some movies that I like the idea of them so much, I just watch them over and over again, and this is one of them. I've probably seen this movie 7 or 8 times. And it's clearly low budget, and I don't mind that. It's just that there are elements of it, like the clocks on their wrists, that I know the CGI probably ate up most of the budget that could have made future cars look cooler. but I love the idea. I'm pretty sure it's the Philip K. Dick story or the other guy. But the idea is that basically... Yeah, the idea is that money has gone away and now time is currency. And when you run out of time, you die. And so you get paid in time, and everybody has a digital clock on their wrist. And if you're poor, like Justin Timberlake and his mom, Olivia Wilde, one of the weird things that once you get to a certain age, you stop aging. So his mom looks the same age as him, and it's kind of creepy. But they're poor. They only have, you know, enough hours to get to tomorrow, and then they got to go to work and get more hours, and sometimes they don't eat. It's just him trying to... He ends up with a shit ton of time that a guy gives him before that guy kills himself, and he goes to live the life of luxury in the better time zones. It's just a little goofy the way that concept is implemented, where there are different time zones to represent like the richer communities. Time zones don't need to play into this at all. I don't know why you had to do that. But I really dig it, but that's only because I see the potential that's in there, the end product does not truly reflect.
No, this is a really, really good answer, because In Time is enjoyable in many moments of this movie. The poker scene is pretty tense in that movie. I agree. In Time is something, you round off some of the edges there. That's a really good movie.
I also have a weird bit of trivia. When he goes to the rich people town and he's in the hotel and he goes to eat breakfast, and there's a girl who's his waitress, mm-hmm. right? And she basically, the conversation is essentially, I can tell that you're new to having a lot of time. You do everything too fast. And he says, not everything.
Yes.
Anyway, the only other time I've ever seen this girl is in The Social Network, also starring Timberlake, when they come to the house and the guy's throwing the beers and the girl doesn't catch him and it hits the wall. That's the same freaking girl.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
I think that's interesting.
Yeah. No, it is. I just don't know her name.
I don't either. We'll look it up later.
Yeah.
Anyway.
By the way, someone up high up in the chat now at this point mentioned Bumblebee being the best Transformers movie. I can't argue with that, actually.
You said the Michael Bay.
The Michael Bay. The Michael Bay versions are the ones that are bad that I think can be good. Meanwhile, Bumblebee is a movie that is already decent. It could obviously be better, but I really liked it, especially because it's Haley Steinfeld instead of fucking Mark Wahlberg and.
She's pretty charming. I don't need that diving thing, but
no,
I like Bumblebee a great deal. So yeah,
talk about that's Chekhov's diving, basically, is what that was.
Chekhov's diving.
Yep.
All right, let's do one more question.
All right.
What actor director would you consider what I would call an all or nothing type of artist, in that you will either completely love or completely hate their work with little to no in between?
I think this is would be an answer of a lot of cinephile type people. Lars von Trier is somebody who would get into that. And I would wager to say even the movies that I like, there are people who just absolutely hate them and have no in between on them. And the movies that I hate, people love, you know, it's that type of thing.
He makes
the movie Dogville, which is 3 hours of a really spare, it feels like a play basically and everything. Dogville. I love Dogville and I love Nymphomaniac, even though it's like just completely just in your face, ridiculousness. But like, I'm not a big fan of, what was it that I wrote down? Antichrist. I'm not a big fan of that movie at all.
Right.
You know, it's maybe just a little bit too much in your face, but I think overall I like Lars von Trier movies, but there's the ones that I don't like are the ones that are just like, yep, you got that visceral hate that you wanted out of me, Lars von Trier, because that's the way, it's kind of filmmaker he is. I think he thrives on hate as much as he thrives on people loving his movies. So,
I'm going to go with Nicholas Winding Refn.
Yeah. Good one.
Most of you, if you have heard of his movies, you've heard of Drive with Ryan Gosling, which in and of itself seems to be a very divisive movie.
Mm-hmm.
I personally love it, but I have met many a film fan that don't like it.
Mm-hmm.
But he also made Only God Forgives, which I enjoyed more than most. He made Neon Demon.
Yeah, which his is movies, a really weird movie.
Yeah, his movies are not what I would call approachable.
Yeah.
But I do tend to like the ones that I've seen. So I think that sort of counts. Sort of answers the question.
There's some nominations for Quentin Tarantino. I can totally see that. Wes Anderson is also being thrown out there. I can see that too. I think directors who have this one distinct thing about them are going to be like that a lot of times. Sometimes that's going to work for you. Sometimes it's not. Eli Roth is brought up. Rob Zombie, which, man, yeah, I don't think I've ever liked a Rob Zombie movie. So all hate, although I know people who love The Devil's Rejects for whatever reason. And then like Terrence Malick is thrown up. Terrence Malick's another good one, because Terrence Malick is so slow and methodical in everything that he does, and especially post The Thin Red Line, after he had that 20-year hiatus where he didn't do anything. He came out with a lot of movies that were like, whoa, I don't know what the fuck that is. Tree of Life, and, you know, stuff like that. Anyway.
Well, I think that's going to do it for the show. I want to say thank you to the guests in the chat here for the live recording. Every episode you guys have added to the discussion, and we know your time is valuable, and we appreciate you spending some of it with us, and for being Patreon peeps and supporting us, and just hope that you guys are also enjoying this experience, and we'll continue to build a Wreckatopia community.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you so much, guys. But that'll be it for our episode 5. Next week is Fresh, the 1994 movie starring Sam Jackson. So watch that one for your homework, and we'll see you later.
See ya.
Bye. Part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.